Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. We live in a world that has suffered the abuses of an unbalanced masculine role for thousands of years. But everything we're hearing and reading right now suggests that the feminine is rising. According to tonight's guests, seeds of feminine wisdom that have been quietly germinating underground are now breaking through the surface. Women everywhere are rising to the collective call to step up and repair our broken earth. And we are activating a paradigm shift such as the world has never seen. Mirror by Star is on the 2020 Watkins list of the 100 most spiritually influential living people of the world. A writer of non-fiction and contemporary translations of sacred literature, she taught philosophy and world religions for 20 years and now teaches and speaks internationally on contemplative practice and inter-spiritual dialogue. Mirabai Star has received critical acclaim for her revolutionary new translations of the mystics, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Julian of Norwich, and is the award-winning author of God of Love, A Guide to the Heart of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, and Caravan of No Despair, a memoir of loss and transformation. Mirabai Star joins me tonight to talk about her latest book, Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics. Mirabai Star, welcome.
Thank you so much, Sandy. What a joy to be with you in these intense, powerful times.
Absolutely, and such a joy to have been reading your book in these times as well. It really brought me back down to what is important. Mirabai, you've been described as a daughter of the counterculture. You were born in New York in the early 60s to secular Jewish parents who challenged institutionalized religion and were active in the anti-war protest movement of the Vietnam era. And when you were 11, your family moved to Taos, New Mexico, where they embraced an alternative back-to-the-land lifestyle in a communal effort to live simply and sustainably. And you write openly about the many twists and turns your life has taken. Tell us a little bit about your early life and how that shaped you.
Well, so my parents were not only non-religious Jews from New York, they were actually really anti-religion. They felt, as I think many people of their generation post-Holocaust, that religion was not only irrelevant but dangerous and responsible for a lot of suffering in the world. And so I grew up with no sense of adherence to any particular faith tradition. They were nominally Jewish by virtue of their cultural identity. But I, on the other hand, starting at a very young age, was just like irrevocably I fell in love, drawn to every single religious tradition that I ever encountered. You know, later in life, I saw that my parents were squarely rooted in Judaism in the sense of social justice. And, you know, Judaism really affirms that we can't know the unknowable God, but we can kind of manifest our relationship with the great mystery in our relationships with each other. So I think they modeled that. But I didn't get any religion from them. And when I started becoming really interested in spirituality and religion, they were very suspicious of what was going on for me. But over the years, I think they really came around and realized that I wasn't joining on any particular institutionalized religious tradition. I simply was kind of temperamentally oriented to respond to the presence of the mystery, of the sacred, of the ineffable in form in all of these different spaces. I could go on about why that happened. Yeah.
Well, it is interesting how people who are not brought up with religion often do find themselves drawn to seeking answers through studying various religions.
Yes, right. Not just one. You know, in fact, I think I was also temperamentally unsuited to pick one tradition to the exclusion of the others. You know, I just, every time I would get deeply connected to a spiritual tradition, whether it was Sufism or Buddhism, I would find myself recoiling against the forms, the structures, the established belief systems, and the prescribed practices. You know, I don't know if it's just because I was a spiritual rebel, but I think that there are many of us who kind of are built that way. We're temperamentally oriented to recognize and praise the presence of the sacred across the spiritual traditions, and kind of incapable of picking one that excludes any of the others.
Yeah, I've met quite a few people like that, and I've often wondered about that. Now, as a teenager, quite young, you lived at the Lama Foundation, an intentional spiritual community in New Mexico. And that's been around since 1968. What were the most important things that you learned there?
Well, I really do believe that my interspiritual orientation was formed, really, in many ways, at the Lama Foundation, because Lama is the place where Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now and created Be Here Now and community there, and where Murshid Samuel Lewis created the Dances of Universal Peace. And Thomas Keating, Father Thomas, gave his first centering prayer retreat. And I could go on and on. Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi. Many Roshis and Lamas and Swamis and rabbis have all done groundbreaking work in that little community up in the mountains of northern New Mexico where we lived. I mean, I lived in Taos, and Lama is about 25 miles up in the mountains outside of Taos, New Mexico. And Lama is a place that has always been about what Murshid Sam called the meeting of the waves. And even Ram Dass, who was Ram Dass of blessed memory, recently left this world and was my lifelong beloved teacher, so I'm mourning him right as we speak. But even Ram Dass was very much an interspiritual teacher, although he had a Hindu guru and he was writing about the so-called Eastern traditions. He was one of those beings who just naturally drew on the wisdom wells of all spiritual paths. And so I was raised in that counterculture world of Taos, New Mexico and Lama Foundation, where I was exposed as a young girl, 11, 12, 13 years old, to multiple spiritual traditions. And all of them were presented as being equally valid and equally true. And I thought that was true for everybody in the world, that anyone, you know, with an open heart would recognize that all these religions were singing the same song of unity and love in deliciously different ways, but that it was a unifying song that they're singing. But as I, you know, grew up, I discovered that that was far from true, although I do think that interspiritual exposure prepared me for the world that we're entering now, where a lot of the existing structures are collapsing, including and maybe especially the organized religious structures, and we're going to need the ability to stand in that fire of not knowing. And not throw the baby of spirituality out with the bathwater of institutionalized religion, but there's still such a deep hunger for spiritual connection and spiritual experience that draws on all the great world's wisdom ways, but is no longer separated off into these little boxes that exclude the other the way that they have been historically.
I'm sure at the time you appreciated it very much, but perhaps didn't fully appreciate until you were much older, and in retrospect, you can look at how you know, being at the Lama Foundation has been so valuable to who you've become and what you do in the world. I mean, you know, how lucky is that to be right there on the doorstep and have that opportunity?
It's so true. I really do recognize now what a blessed experience that was, you know, to come of age in that kind of milieu, and how much it informs everything I do every day of my life now. Mm. All those teachers, these historic, yes. Now many of them are dead now, these teachers who just have been change makers in the world, and I got to just be with them at such a young age and didn't realize how significant that would be, except insofar as sitting with them was a powerful experience, you know, many powerful experiences with these teachers that I did recognize at the time. Wow, they shattered my foundation over and over again and remade me every time I would have a new spiritual experience in the presence of these great beings.
Mm, I can imagine. So how and when did you first develop a connection with the great Christian mystics?
Well, you know, at Lama, I was exposed to Sufism. That's one of the prevalent paths, I would say, at Lama Foundation. And Sufism in various different forms. The Mevlevi Sufi order of Jalaluddin Rumi, Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi, the great Persian poet. And the contemporary Western Sufi movement that's now known as the Ruhaniyat. And other Sufi traditions. So I had very much a Sufi heart because Sufism is kind of rooted in the lover-beloved metaphor, which really resonated with me and still does. And so when I was 20, I decided to do a semester abroad in Spain, in Seville, studying mm-hmm. Spanish literature. I was majoring, I had a dual major in anthropology and Spanish. So I decided living with a family and studying Spanish literature would be a great way to become fluent, and indeed it was. It was the time when I went from kind of nominal street Spanish from growing up, traveling a lot in Mexico, to becoming fluent. And so when I was studying Spanish literature, I encountered San Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross, who's known, mm-hmm. of course, for his mystical masterpiece, Dark Night of the Soul. And I was reading his poetry. He has an incredible body of poetic work. And every poem I read reminded me of Rumi. It was almost like he was stealing Rumi's material. And just down to very specific metaphors like the fire and the garden and the wine and intoxication and those kinds of images, lover and beloved having a secret rendezvous in the garden. And so I just became deeply enamored of John of the Cross. And when I returned from Spain, actually a year or so later when I left, I graduated with my degree in anthropology and went to graduate school in philosophy and religious studies, I decided to do my master's thesis on St. John of the Cross. And I remember being told that nobody understands St. John of the Cross. Like, basically, you, a woman, have no business dabbling in this great mystical genius. And so those were just fighting words. And I I dove in head first and just resonated so deeply with John of the Cross and ended up then translating in my late 30s, Dark Night of the Soul into English. And once that happened, once I translated St. John of the Cross, it opened the floodgates to the Christian mystics for me. I mean, I had studied them in graduate school, Teresa of Avila, Hildegard of Bingen, Julian of Norwich, and many others. But something about the intensity and intimacy of translating John of the Cross just kind of melted any barriers that I had in my heart to Christianity. And the wisdom of the Christian mystics just came pouring in. And not only did I fall in love with all the Christian mystics, but through them develop this intimate relationship and love for Christ himself. I mean, You have to understand that growing up in an anti-religious Jewish household and studying and practicing all of the Eastern traditions, having met Ram Dass very young, I became a devotee of the great Indian saint Neem Karoli Baba, who is still my guru. I developed a very disciplined Buddhist meditation practice at a young age, basic Vipassana practice, which I still do. There was Sufism. There's, you know, the Native American traditions of my beloved hometown of Taos, New Mexico. Many different traditions except for Christianity, basically all of them, except for Christianity, which I had this kind of cellular aversion to. I think it's ancestral trauma. Whatever it is, it was a definite block in my heart to Christianity. But through the Christian mystics who speak in such a universal language of love, I was able to connect with these Christian mystics. And then I don't even know how it happened, Sandy. Just suddenly I was being asked to translate various Christian mystics and write about different Christian mystics. And suddenly I found myself inhabiting this space of speaking to and about Christian mysticism as a Jewish, Sufi, Hindu, Buddhist, pagan.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with interspiritual author and teacher Mirabai Starr, whose award-winning nonfiction and contemporary translations of sacred literature have received worldwide critical acclaim. And we're talking about her latest book, Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics, which has been called essential reading for anyone ready to awaken the feminine mystic within. We'll be back with more from Mirabai Starr after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times flagship radio show, What Is Going On. As a longtime editor, book judge, spiritual magazine publisher and radio host, I've read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors and teachers. So I know what's worth reading and what isn't. Now, with the spiritual book market growing increasingly crowded, more and more people are seeking my help in finding the authentic voices, the empowering tools, and the genuine skip the BS guidance that will make the most difference to their spiritual development. So I decided to make it easier by bringing my knowledge, experience, and considerable network of contacts together in the No BS Spiritual Book Club. There are no ads, no joining fees, no obligations, and no BS. Just an ever-growing library compiled by recognisable and respected names of the 10 best books that help them the most on their journeys. Plus, free book excerpts, audios, and live video interviews where you can quiz them about their spiritual journeys and their 10 best list choices. Your time and money are valuable, your spiritual journey even more so. If you're looking for genuine guidance from people who've walked this path before you, check out sedgbeer.com. Click on the No BS Spiritual Book Club tab and join the club. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com. I'll see you there.
I am Fidel Mshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family, and then, boom, Everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Mirabai Starr, you've written so many critically acclaimed books about the medieval mystics. What elements moved in your personal mystical innerscape to bring about the birth of your latest book, Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics?
Well, so many of the religious traditions and teachings that I have spent a lifetime immersed in are conspicuously missing the voice of the feminine. And I couldn't ignore that anymore. That every time I was exploring and lifting up these mystical traditions, they were the voices of men that I was sharing. And in even the beliefs and practices that I cherished the most, and most of my own teachers were masculine voices. And I, instead of looking for the voice of the feminine, the wisdom of women outside of myself and my own work, I realized it was kind of my turn to excavate and share those jewels myself, because it wasn't happening elsewhere. I mean, there were lots of women in their own spiritual traditions bringing out the voices of women, but not anyone that I knew of anyway that was doing that across the spiritual traditions, which is kind of my area of interest, is interspirituality. So I began to look for those wisdom teachings of women in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, indigenous traditions, and it was much more difficult than I thought it would be to find them, and it was, I quickly realized that it was difficult because it was intentionally made that way, that the voice of the feminine was intentionally buried and marginalized and sidelined by the patriarchy, basically, because feminine wisdom is subversive. It threatens the status quo and the existing structures of institutionalized religion, and always has. And that now is the time to go ahead and fearlessly shake it up with these feminine voices of wild wisdom. You know, the reason I titled my new book Wild Mercy is because for me the feminine embodies that paradox, actually a whole range of paradoxes, mm-hmm. from loving kindness and unconditional forgiveness to ferocity and subversiveness and resistance and wild spontaneous creativity. And those are, all of those are qualities actually that can be quite threatening when you're trying to keep people in line with particular belief systems and ritual containers that leave no room for the actual living voice of the Holy Spirit to direct what's unfolding in the landscape of the soul.
Now, do you find great irony in the timing of it? I mean, you write in Wild Mercy that you were first writing the proposal just...
Our time, it urgently is, and that the voice of the feminine is needed now more than ever. And I know that I was right to rise up out of my own cynicism and allow myself to be, as so many people are all over the world, a conduit for this rising feminine energy. Because look now at how urgently the qualities and attributes of feminine wisdom and heart are directly relevant to the to the changes that are upon us. But the masculine in, structured, exclusive, perfection-oriented, purity-oriented kind of spiritual culture is not going to be relevant or useful in these times of creative chaos and the death of these structures that we have known. But the feminine will and is holding, holding the space for the death and the birth that is happening in our midst.
What is your definition of a mystic, and how would you characterize the path of the feminine mystic?
The classic kind of academic definition of a mystic is one who has a direct experience of the divine, that is, unmediated through established religious channels like spiritual religious authorities, clergy people, or prescribed prayers and rituals. That a mystic has a direct experience of God or of the sacred, usually in the form of love, of boundless love, and a mystical experience bypasses the established, accepted forms and belief systems, even that the mystic herself might have come from. For instance, Teresa of Avila, my beloved Teresa of Avila, whose masterworks I've had the great good fortune of translating. She was squarely rooted in Christianity, although she was only a first-generation Christian because her family was, she came from a converso family, a family of Jews who were forced to convert by the Inquisition. She lived in the early 16th century in Spain, height of the Inquisition. So she was Jewish and Christian, although she had to deny her Jewish roots. But when she had her experience of union with the one she called beloved, it was undifferentiated. It was a, it was an experience of intimate merging into the source of all love and the dissolution of any individual identity or subject to object experience or relationship. But when she returned to her so-called ordinary state of consciousness, she translated that experience through the filter of her Christianity, and it became the experience of a Christian mystic. But even William James writes about this in the in his famous book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, in his chapter on mysticism, that when we, any of us, and I believe, by the way, Sandy, and I know many of you believe, that we are all mystics and that it is our birthright to have these experiences of union with love, but that we all end up having to put language around that which is ineffable, which transcends all language and all concepts, in order to attempt to hold and ultimately to share the blessing of what happened to us. The discursive mind, which is which comes with the territory of being a human being, as does the ego, as does do the emotions and the body and bodily experiences. All of this is part of being a human being. It's all sacred ground, and we end up having to use the apparatus that we're given to reflect back to ourselves this our experiences of ultimate reality. But those experiences themselves are intimate and much, much bigger than any words or concepts could possibly describe. So now, that's a mystic. A mystic is someone who has that direct experience. And and you wanted me to reflect on the feminine version of that? In some ways, I feel like the mystical experience in itself is a feminine experience. Because it's an experience that defies or transcends the existing, what would I say, dogma, order, ideas about what spiritual means, and it invites us into fully inhabit the realm of the heart, and that this is the space of the feminine. So now is the perfect time to say that when I speak about feminine and masculine, I am speaking about an energetic reality.
Yes.
I'm speaking about attributes and qualities that exist and abide in all of us, in women, in men, in people of all genders, and people who do not identify with a particular gender at all. And yet, all of us, I feel, right now, are yearning for the gift of feminine wisdom, the voice of feminine wisdom, and the heart space into which the feminine invites us, because this is her domain. And so I know plenty of women in the spiritual arena who lead with masculine qualities, who are as patriarchal as any priest or rabbi or imam or shaman or what else, yogi.
Mm-hmm.
Roshi, Lama, you know, that the masculine kind of hierarchical definitions of what it means to be spiritual are a trap that women also fall into, and then they end up kind of leading with the very masculine qualities, or perpetuating the masculine paradigms that have historically oppressed us. And I know many, many men who are voluntarily abdicating their privilege and power, you know, even many clergy people across the spiritual traditions who are stepping back and shutting up and inviting women and people who speak, who sing the song of the feminine, speak in the voice of the feminine, to take the mic, to take the stage, to have the space to now bring this vitally needed elixir of feminine wisdom and heart into the human community. So that is to say that I'm talking about the feminine in all of us, and she's alive and well in people of all genders, just as the masculine is still doing its patriarchal thing in the form of certain women leaders. Yeah.
So, you know, as all of this is happening, as we are all becoming aware of the feminine rising, and I think some people are not entirely sure what that term means or what it looks like. I mean, it's almost become a cliche, but we definitely know that something is happening of that nature. How are the tapestries of the stories and lives and examples from the mystic women that you write about across all the different spiritual traditions and time frames, how are they useful to us now?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I feel like story is vitally important in these times. That story and personal, specific experiences of the human condition are what are going to lift us all up and remind us about the web of interbeing to which we belong. So that my story, my very particular human story, becomes a reflection of everybody's story. And that when you hear details of my experience walking this world, it will awaken you and welcome you home to your own experience. And so when I tell the stories of all of these different women mystics across the religious landscape and backward in time and currently, it's people resonate and we see ourselves in these wisdom beings. I mean, just the other day I was thinking about Hildegard of Bingen, the 12th century Rhineland visionary Christian mystic who celebrated nature, the natural world, as the very dwelling place of the divine feminine. In the form of Sophia and Mother Mary and the earth herself, she blended it all together. And Hildegard as a young girl, was having all of these prophetic kinds of experiences, accompanied often by blinding headaches. And then the voice of what she called the living light would speak to her. And she kept trying to suppress it because the people around her when she was a girl, the adults, and then later just other people seemed very suspicious of her visionary experiences. And so it wasn't safe for her to share them. And she did everything she could to repress them until the voice of the living light was so powerful that it almost killed her to try to keep a lid on it. It was shattering her container. And so finally she just surrendered and said, okay, hineni is the word in Hebrew, not for okay, but for here I am. I accept this prophetic calling. I will be a vessel for your wisdom and your love in this world. And then out of that surrender came pouring through the most extraordinary wisdom. She was truly a polymath. She was a musician. She was a composer. Hildegard's music resounds through the centuries. She was an artist who created these illuminations. She was an architect. She was a social critic. She was a healer with herbs and tinctures and stones and minerals and crystals. There were so many ways that Hildegard's mastery manifested and comes down to us through the 1,000 years since she lived, in such a way that it's relevant right now in this time of crisis and confusion and separation and the call to unity that is at the heart of the deconstruction that's unfolding right now.
Do you think that, I mean, the experiences they had are obviously available to all of us, but many of us don't believe that we could have those kinds of numinous experiences. You know, these women, these mystic women, I mean, they were polymaths, they were beings of wisdom. Would you say that it was their abilities to see and think about the world from a different perspective that inspired them to the spiritual and mystical practices? Or was it the other way around, that it was their devotional aspect that brought them to the path of self-realization?
Yes. And what I mean by that is that one of the hallmarks for me of the feminine wisdom space is that it's so vast that it can hold seemingly contradictory propositions in this beautiful paradoxical third reality. For instance, when I say yes to both of those, I know that a lot of people make a distinction these days between non-dualism and devotional practices, what they call bhakti yoga in the Hindu tradition, of being devoted to the beloved as a being that is other, versus knowing that there is no separation between ourselves and ultimate reality, that there is non-duality, not two-ness, that we are that which we seek. And there's been this sort of paradoxically dualism set up between the non-dualists and the devotional being, as if you were an illusion if you had this devotional impulse toward the beloved, whereas you were truly enlightened if you understood that there is only one and there is no separation. But to me, the feminine inhabits seamlessly, fluidly, generously and extravagantly both of those realities of non-duality, like of course lover and beloved are already and always have been and ever shall be one. And there is this beautiful way in which devotional practices like poetry and singing and prayer open the heart to a felt connection with that which we are connecting to, let's call it the beloved for fun, and that experience of devotion, then the warmth and fire of the soul's longing for God melts the very container that separates us, and we flow into the one that we are seeking. And so non-duality can become very abstract and philosophical, And devotion actually, although it seems dualistic on its face, warms and softens the heart to actually then inhabit a non-dual state of intimate union with love itself. So to come back to your question about, do these women mystics start off with a devotional impulse, maybe you could sort of rephrase it, since I kind of wandered all around there.
It's a bit of a chicken and egg, isn't it? I mean, is it the devotional aspect within them?
That brings them to awakening. Like, is it that devotional heart within them that helps them wake up? Or is it in some ways something that they were born with, this ability to see through those awakened eyes? I think it's both. As I described this vast container that allows for devotion and non-duality in the single feminine space vessel of the heart, I think that many of us, you, me, many people listening or reading this, as long as we can remember, we've had this sense of the numinous and this deep attraction to the great mystery. And that has enabled us to cultivate a very broad perspective, so that we can see we can perceive the presence of the sacred in so many different spaces, in just a vast array of spaces. Yes, that it's something that many of us sort of came into this life with. But I also think that the path of love, the path of mystical devotion, can enable us at any point in our lives to cultivate that deep seeing, that contemplative way of looking through the eyes of the heart at any time in our lives, that this is our birthright to all be mystics, that is, to all be beings in love with love and able to and totally worthy of having an experience of union.
I'm glad you said that. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest is mystical feminist and critically acclaimed author of creative nonfiction and contemporary translations of sacred literature, Mirror by Star. And we're talking about her latest book.
Cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Mirror by Star. Tragedy and trauma are common themes in the lives of the mystics you write about. John of the Cross was imprisoned for his attempts to reform the church. St. Francis of Assisi was a prisoner of war. St. Teresa of Avila suffered illness, hardship and persecution by the Inquisition. And Julian of Norwich received her visions in the midst of great illness and believing she was on her deathbed. Do you think that tragedy and trauma, you know, I mean, they're such powerful triggers for transformation. But why is that? You know, why do we have to plumb the depths before our eyes can truly open?
Oh, I have no idea, Sandy. I mean, none of us do. But I think that the question underlying that is, what do we do with it? You know, that the human condition, as everyone from the Buddha to Jesus, see, even I name dudes as the exemplars of spiritual enlightenment. But anyway, it has always been affirmed that the human condition is a place that involves great suffering and challenge, and that how we respond is the test of our true humanity. And to me, when I say our true humanity, that is inextricable from our spirituality, that it is not in rising above the human condition. So for me, it was the loss of a child. When The Dark Night of the Soul, my first book, the translation of Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross, with my commentaries, a teaching that I had loved ever since I was 20 years old in Spain, and I encountered it, and I was 40 when Dark Night of the Soul came out. The very day that book came into the world, my first book, my 14-year-old daughter Jenny was killed in a car accident. And I entered into the heart of that fire that I had been studying about and practicing and encountering through spiritual methodologies for decades. But in that moment in which Jenny's death coincided with the release into the world of these teachings on the transformational power of great darkness and suffering, I had to fully surrender any ideas I had on what spirituality was, what mystical union was, what God was, what my life as a human being, as a woman, as a mother was supposed to be about. And that transfiguration of my soul was not some sudden enlightenment experience where I used to be a schmuck and now I was this great wisdom generator. It was rather a very messy, slow, gradual process of fully inhabiting my own humanity. And in doing so, taking my rightful place in the web of interbeing to which I suddenly realized I belong. And in that surrender, that gradual, somewhat chaotic up and down process of coming home to my human heart, the world of the soul became bigger and more accessible.
And I've never thought about loss in that way before. As you say, grief opens the door to holy desire, which in turn leads us into the arms of that which we yearn for. There's so much I wish we had more time to talk about. You know, if you could see my notes, I've got so many of them. But we are almost out of time. And I just wanted to quickly touch on, you know, the divine masculine, because we get to a part in the book where you say, well, so where do I find the divine masculine? And then, of course, you found it in your husband. And so often, you know, we are looking beyond the men we know. We're looking at all of their, you know, masculine, you know, differences and the things that, you know, mark them out as not us. And we don't see the divine masculine within them. You know, was that a surprise to you when you came back to that and you saw the divine masculine in your husband?
No, not at all. I've seen the divine masculine in him from the day that I met him. And there are so many men in my life and other gendered people as well who are just luminaries for me of the antidote to the toxic masculinity that I am resisting in my work right now, that I'm calling out. You know, that so it's not that I am condemning all men as being the source of the problem. Far from it. I feel like I have so many allies in men and other gendered people right now who are just as interested in unlocking the door to the feminine heart that has also imprisoned men. And so they're grateful, yes, and they're involved in this process, and they're delighted to find out about all these women mystics. You know, that they have other places to find their own feminine heart in this world, besides the exclusive boys' club that has characterized most of the religious institutions, including the ones that many of us consider to be alternative by virtue of the fact that they're Eastern. You know, Hinduism and Buddhism are supposed to be exempt from that kind of misogyny and patriarchy, but they're not.
Mm. There is such a big conversation here. I'd really love to continue it at some point. I'm going to have to close with this thought. You write about Julian of Norwich, and you say that she has a message for today's readers, which is very simply that she reveals the feminine face of the divine and reminds us to see God there, that all our failings are an opportunity to learn and grow, that they should be honoured but not dwelled upon, that God's love has nothing to do with love and retribution and everything to do with love and compassion. And most of all, in spite of all appearances, all is well. As you look upon the world as it is right now, in the middle of this incredible situation that we've never experienced before, is all well?
All is well, and that includes that which is not well, and that we need to be in our courageous feminine hearts and make space for all of it, to not check out of it and bypass it through spiritual methods, but to allow our hearts to break open in response to the pain of the world.
Mirabai Starr, thank you for that reminder. Thank you for joining us today. You can learn more about Mirabai Starr's work at her website, mirabaistarr.com. MirabaiStarr. We're out of time, I'm afraid. That's all for tonight. I'll be with you again at the same time next week.